everyone. This is Steve Donahue with another episode of the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. Today's episode is number 55, and I want to begin by apologizing that I have not had a podcast out here in a few days, and that is a result of a bad power outage that we had here in the area. We had a big storm come through. It was apparently up to 80-mile-an-hour winds, although we got almost no rain with it. And it was kind of spotty with its winds, but through our area, it came through with heavy force, took out my greenhouse. The heat, along with all the wind and the trauma, killed off several of our animals, and we just had quite a time. Knocked out the power. We lost power on Friday evening and did not get it restored back till Sunday evening. So I normally record a podcast on Friday, and what you're going to hear today is the podcast that I would have recorded that Friday, but was unable to, and we did not even have church on Sunday because most of the people in the area did not have power, although the church did, but we did not even have church, and so I don't have my message up there either. So it's been a couple of days since you've heard from me, although I tried to blog indicating something about the power outage, and I've took a few videos I'll have up for you. But anyway, today's episode is going to be on three news events or three news items that talk about the lack of freedom that we have in our country. And I want to address these because, they're in the news, and because it's important for us to be aware of the ways in which much of our freedoms are being taken away or are being challenged as a result of what governments are doing locally as well as nationally. And so we're going to look at those. But before we do that, I want to direct you to the website. Make sure that you are keeping up with all of the updates on there. And I will be having some more videos coming through here soon with some more reviews and things like that. You want to make sure you're up to date on all of those. Best way to do that is actually if you register to become a user of the website, that will enable you to get all of the email updates indicating when new items come out, that kind of thing. So you can do that on the right column of the website. Just go on the website and register there, username. I promise I won't spam you with all kinds of email. You only get email when a new item is coming out on the website, let you know about that. Also, I want to encourage you to follow us on all the various social media. We've got Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And then be sure that you are sharing us with friends and family as well so that we might continue to grow. And we've had a big surge the last few weeks. I appreciate all of you who are letting the word out and getting the word to friends and family and coworkers, that kind of thing, about what we do here. And we're continuing to grow. Hope it continues to increase exponentially as it has. And appreciate those of you who are giving me feedback. And I would encourage you to give me feedback. Best way to do that is steve@thelegacypodcast.com. You can do that directly to me. That comes to me. Also, you can give me feedback through each of the episodes if you want to just make a comment or two about the episode. Now, of course, you have to be a registered user of the website to do that, so that's another reason for you to register. But that's also another way in which you can provide me with some feedback, and I encourage you to do that. And then finally, if you like what we do and you want to support the show, the best way to do that is becoming a Legacy Partner. Our Legacy Partner program is $30 a year or $3 a month, and with that, you get about $50 worth of value. Various items are in there, some more are coming on the way, and it enables you to support the show at less than a quarter an episode. So if you think what you hear here is worth about 20 cents or 25 cents, then I encourage you to become a part of the Legacy Partner program. And with that, this concludes the introductory segment of today's show. So let's go ahead and get right into some of the content. The first one that I want to bring up, and I'll have links to all of these articles in the show notes, but this is a link to an article I read on the Homeschool Legal Defense Association's e-alert service. And it takes place in Delaware, although I want us to be aware of it, even if we don't live in Delaware, because trends seem to take their course throughout the various states. And when one does something, the precedent is set for there to be others to follow. And so this occurs in Delaware. And I'm going to read some of the article and make some comments to it, and then you can read the rest of it. But yesterday, that is on the 26th of June, the House Judiciary Committee approved Senate Bill 234 by unanimous vote of 7-0. It now goes to the full House of Representatives, which will vote on it either later on that day or even this week. And probably by the time you're getting this or hearing this, they will have already voted on it. But anyway, Senate Bill 234, sponsored by Senate Majority Leader Patricia M. Blevins of District 7, creates a definition of the term physical injury in the child abuse and neglect laws to include pain. Currently, the law permits a parent to use force to punish a child for misconduct, but it prohibits any act that is likely to cause or does cause physical injury. So with the expansion of the word physical injury here to include pain, it severely limits the amount or severely limits the ability of parents to be able to discipline their children through spanking. By definition, the physical injury includes the infliction of pain on a child. Spanking would become a crime in Delaware, punishable by imprisonment for up to 2 years. Now, the intent of this law was not to prevent spanking. It was to crack down on child abuse. And I am avidly opposed to child abuse. However, I also know that when a father neglects to discipline his children properly, that's actually a form of child abuse. And so there's a balance that needs to take place here. And of course, I believe that this law tips the balance in the wrong direction, in the sense that what it does is it severely hampers the ability of parents to cause physical pain in spanking. And if pain is not caused in spanking, then the spanking really doesn't have an effect. It's got to cause pain for it to actually have its effect. So I'm going to go on with the article. We do not believe that the intent of the bill, this is the HSLDA, a writer here speaking, we do not believe that the intent of the bill was to outlaw corporal discipline. The purpose appears to be to strengthen child abuse and neglect laws. Unfortunately, the effect of this bill is to prohibit a well-meaning parent from doing anything to a child that would cause pain. So obviously, this would include spanking. The analysis of this bill, we have been from a member of the House and representatives of the Delaware Attorney General's Office, failed to consider a plain reading of the current law that it is not permissible to cause physical injury to a child, and that the Senate Bill 234 would define physical injury as pain. A simple solution to this dilemma would be to simply remove the definition of physical injury from the bill. But, of course, that has not been done, and it doesn't seem to be that there is any intention for that to take place. So the bill passed in the Senate unanimously on June 19, 2012 by a vote of 21-0. If this bill is then enacted, Delaware would become the first state in the nation to outlaw corporal discipline of children by their parents. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I am avidly opposed to child abuse. However, I also know that the overarching politicians grab for power is making it very difficult for parents to obey the scriptures, because the scriptures are very clear, particularly in Proverbs. I just want to read a few passages in Proverbs here. The Proverbs says that spanking is good for children. In fact, it says, spare the rod, spoil the child, in Proverbs 13:24. It also says, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. In Proverbs 23, verse 4, it says, you shall beat him with the rod and deliver his soul from death. And then Proverbs 23, verse 13, it says, do not withhold correction from a child, for if you beat him with the rod, he will not die. And so those are very clear indications that it's important for fathers particularly to discipline their children with the rod. And it has to cause pain in order for there to be proper discipline. It should be done obviously lovingly, and it should not be done in anger. And there, you know, there's boundaries that need to be set for parents when it comes to disciplining their children in this way. But by prohibiting parents from causing pain when a child is spanked is preventing a parent from being effective, both in their parenting and in their responsibility as a parent. So that's the first item, is the anti-spanking bill in the House of Delaware. The second article I want to bring to you is from Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you may have heard about this from another podcast, or maybe you've read about it itself, but the news article says this: Tulsa, Oklahoma, a Tulsa woman is suing the city's code enforcement officers after she said that they would cut down her garden with no cause. Denise Morrison said that she had more than 100 plant varieties in her front and backyard, and all of them are edible and have a purpose. So the first article we looked at, that was from a state level. That was a state trying to impose a certain regulation or certain law upon parents and enforcing that. Here we have a local ordinance, or local Tulsa, Oklahoma city ordinance, declaring that this woman's property is in need of change. And more specific, we'll get to it in a minute. But it says here that she had more than 100 different plant varieties in her yard, all of which had an edible or beneficial purpose. That's incredible. I mean, there are very few yards across, there are many, very few gardens, yards, however you want to call them, across the nation who have 100 different varieties of anything, much less those that are edible and practical and medicinal in the garden. So this is incredible that she would have this, and how important it is to encourage people who have this kind of cornucopia of various products in their garden. She knows which ones will treat arthritis, the article says, which ones will make your food spicy, which ones will keep mosquitoes away, treat bug bites. And she said none of this mattered to the city inspectors. And, you know, in case we think that, you know, the bureaucrats that work in our localities have some real interest in taking care of us or doing what's right for us, make a note here that at least in this instant, they didn't care that she had these things and that she knew what they were and that they were doing it. They were just there to supposedly enforce a county ordinance or a city ordinance. So the article goes on. It says, last August, Morrison's front and backyard were filled with flowers in bloom: lemon, stevia, garlic chives, grapes, strawberries, apple mint, spearmint, peppermint, an apple tree, walnut tree, pecan trees, and much more. Doesn't that sound great? I mean, what an ideal place, garden that is filled with diverse vegetation and plants and trees. And man, that's just magnificent. But unfortunately, it says that she received a letter from the city saying that there was a complaint about her yard. Now, I want to pause just for a minute. I don't know who it was that complained, some neighbor or somebody that drove by or something and saw all this in her front yard and complained. That person ought to be found and ought to be exported to Cuba or something like that, where you know, they will begin to experience what authoritative governments are really like. That's just ridiculous that they would complain about something like that without knowing their neighbor. They obviously didn't even know what these things were, because in a minute we'll see that the regulations state that they had to be edible or medicinal or, you know, useful to human type plants. And she had all of those. They were useful. And so this person obviously just saw this and said, well, you know, that looks maybe untidy or something like that. And so they complained, but it's just absolutely ridiculous that it would complain. So it says she took some pictures of her property and of the various flowers and everything that was in her yard to the city inspectors. But it says they wouldn't listen. So she invited them to her home so that they could point out the problems. And what did they say? They said, everything must go. And that's in quotes. Morrison said that that's what she told her, or that's what they told her. And so when she said that she wanted to cut, they wanted to cut them all down, she called the police. Officer came out and issued a citation so that it would be covered in court. So that's actually a good plan. The court, you know, take it to court so that it's actually settled in court rather than having a bureaucrat come and just make their own decisions about what needed to be done. Unfortunately, the very next paragraph says that she went to court on August 15th, and the judge told them to come back in October, but the very next day, men were cutting down most of her plants. So here is the bureaucracy and the bureaucrats and the code enforcement officials and their henchmen who are refusing even to wait for the court date to determine what would happen, but come out and take things into their own hands and cut down everything in her garden and in her yard. I don't know if this makes you mad, but it just makes me upset. And it says they even cut down some of her trees. one which bore fruits and nuts. And they went back the next day to her house and basically removed everything in her front flower bed. So, you know, she had this garden in her front yard of trees and vegetation and all different kinds of medicinal plants and healthful plants and edible plants and a flower garden, all these kinds of things. They come in and they remove the whole thing. It says she comes back 3 days later. Apparently she's on a trip after the thing. She comes back, says she just waited in the driveway, cried, and then she left. All of this work that she had put in, all of these different varieties of plants and vegetation, destroyed by the county officials. Morrison said she had a problem with her last property, and because of that, when she moved to this new property, she very specifically looked at what the ordinance said, and she says that plants over 12 inches tall had to be used for human consumption. She made sure that she grew, could be eaten, and consumed. And so she was following the regulations precisely, and she had checked on those regulations before she even moved there. And she told all this to the inspectors. But you know what the inspectors said? They said, "We don't care." And so obviously they had in their mind that it was their job to enforce some regulation that's not even in the books, or to interpret the regulation in the books in such a way that everything in her yard had to go. Morrison said that she used many of the plants that were destroyed to treat her diabetes, her high blood pressure, and arthritis. Not only were the plants my livelihood, she says, they were my food, and I was unemployed and at the time and had no food left, no medicine left, and I didn't have insurance. They took away my life and my livelihood. And so, you know, the article goes on, talks about some of the other struggles that she had, and what the court case is doing and where it is in the procedure. And, you know, the sad thing about all this, well, there's a lot of different sad things, but one of the sad things about this is this code enforcement official is not fired. She ought to be fired for this, going out and harassing the citizens of their locality, the city, I guess it is, harassing them for growing edible plants and medicinal plants in their front yard. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And yet that's the kind of government intrusion that is taking place in the cities across America. And so that's the second article. That was on a city level. And this one here is on a national level, and you've probably heard much about it. You've probably already responded to it in little ways, but I have to bring it up, and that is the Supreme Court ruling on Obamacare. And this is actually the article that I'm going to read or refer to here is from the Daily Beast, which I wouldn't necessarily recommend in all cases, but it seems to be a very fair and accurate description of the proceedings that took place and the ruling that resulted with regard to the Obamacare. And the Daily Beast is a branch of Newsweek. And so, you know, it's not the bastion of conservative or libertarian news that I would normally look at. But certainly it has a good description here. And the first thing I want to say is that, you know, the subtitle of the article is "An Insider's Guide to the Supreme Court's Dramatic Ruling Upholding the Affordable Care Act" by Jesse Wegman. And here's a hint for you. Anytime the government calls a law or names a law, the exact opposite of that law is what it eventually does. So the Affordable Care Act is actually going to make health care less affordable. And so keep that in mind as we go through this and think about what has resulted from this. So here's what the article says. What exactly does the Supreme Court rule? By a 5-4 margin in a decision surprisingly written by traditionally conservative Chief Justice John Roberts. First of all, we think that we have an idea of what is conservative and what is a liberal judge. But the reality of it is, if you look back at the various court rulings, most do not really have some of them vote one way and some of them vote the other way pretty consistently. But when it comes right down to it, almost all of them are not conservative in a sense of holding to a strict interpretation of the Constitution. So that's just a side note. So traditionally conservative Chief Justice John Roberts, the court ruled that the health care law is constitutional. The law's most controversial component, known as the individual mandate, requires all Americans to purchase health care or to pay a shared responsibility payment. All right, now let me pause right there. What's a shared responsibility payment? That sounds to me like communism. You've heard the saying before that for each according to his, what? For each according to his ability, to each according to his need. Doesn't that sound exactly like what a shared responsibility payment is? That sounds like from the heart of communism. And so, anyway, requires all Americans to purchase health insurance or pay a shared responsibility payment to the government. On the day the law was enacted, 26 states, several individuals, and others sued to have the law struck down as a violation of the Constitution's Commerce Clause, which gives the federal government the power to regulate commerce between the states. The Commerce Clause has been an over-abused, just an overreach by the government to involve itself in every aspect of commerce. Whether it be a farmer who wants to produce his own food and consume it on his own farm, they consider that commerce because it's involved in not buying food somewhere else. And so the Commerce Clause has been greatly abused. And it was under this conclusion that the Obamacare was supposedly constitutional. But we'll see here in just a moment how this was all changed. So, in its ruling, the court held that the law could not be upheld under the Commerce Clause. Well, that's a good news. They at least they realized that if the Commerce Clause was the means by which this thing was to be approved, then anything goes. But that's not so good because it goes on. It says, which was the government's primary argument in support? The federal government does not have the power to order people to pay health insurance. Well, hallelujah. And so, what does that mean, though? Does it mean that we're off the hook? Well, not at all. And so the Commerce Clause argument was only one of the three government made to support the law. And so, you know, when they argued this before the Supreme Court, the government argued, among other things, the Commerce Clause. And so there was apparently two other arguments that they made, one of which was a tax argument. And it says here, it also argued that the law could be considered a tax, and this is the argument the court bought. Now, if you go back and you look at what Obama was saying about this, he was saying that the mandate and the fee for not purchasing the insurance was not a tax, that it couldn't be a tax, and it wasn't supposed to be accepted as a tax. And now we have the Congress, you know, we have the jury, or the Supreme Court coming out and saying that it is a tax. Article goes on, specifically the court held that the individual mandate is not a penalty, as the health care law identified it, but a tax, and therefore constitutional application of the Congress's taxation power. Okay, so what taxing power? Look at the Constitution and find one place in the Constitution where the government, the Congress, is given the ability to tax somebody for not participating in something. There, you can't find it. In deciding to accept the government's tax argument, the article says, the court wrote that the question is not whether that it is the most natural interpretation of the mandate, but only whether it is fairly possible one. So now we have judges not deciding upon the constitutionality of a certain law, but whether or not any argument might be possible. And upon any argument being possible, then anything goes. And so where is the restriction here? In accepting the tax argument, the court relied on the well-established principle that if a statute has two possible meanings, one which violates the Constitution, court should adopt the meaning that does not do so. I just can't believe this. And so the court is ruling that although the individual mandate is unconstitutional according to the Commerce Clause, that the whole law is not unconstitutional because the fee, which is really not a fee, can be considered tax, which the Congress has the ability to tax, even though they don't have the ability to tax like this. And so this is just so convoluted. In other words, it gives you the benefit of doubt if there's any benefit of doubt there. And that's pretty much the way that the judges are ruling now, is that if there's any possible way that the government can be expanded through this law, we'll do it. The court then noted the government's argument that the mandate represented a tax on people who choose not to buy health insurance makes going without insurance just another thing the government taxes, like buying gasoline or earning income. Okay, so they mentioned this a little bit later too, and I don't know whether this is interpretation from the author or whether this is actually the judge's argument. If it's the judge's argument, they are clueless as to what they're talking about here, because it says that it's like buying gasoline. No, it's not. Because if there's a tax on gasoline, you don't have to buy it. To make it comparable, it would be like putting a tax on the healthcare premiums so that those that want to purchase the healthcare premiums would be able to purchase it. It's not like gasoline or gasoline tax that we would be taxed if we don't want to participate in the program. That's nothing like it. That's paying for a tax that you don't even participate in. In deciding to accept the government's tax argument, the court wrote that the question is not whether that it is the most natural interpretation of mandate, but only whether it is a fairly possible one. So how can the court call a mandate a tax if the law itself didn't call it that? That's a good question. That's the question that the author of this article brings up. It says the court is not bound to interpret laws exactly as they are written, but uses what is called functional approach, considering the substance of the law in addition to its formal language. In other words, they take the spirit of the law and not just the letter of law. So if someone in Congress or if Congress makes a law and that law is challenged, then the Supreme Court is allowed to look at what the intent and what the spirit of that law brought about. And if the spirit of the law is in good measure, well, then it's accepted. I don't know where they get this stuff. So next paragraph says, under this approach, the court ruled that the penalty the law imposes on people who don't buy health insurance looks like a tax in many respects, and that it's permissible under the court's previous case law. Well, that's the problem there. See, they don't look at the Constitution anymore. All they do is they look at what previous court case law said, because they don't want to overturn any previous case law. And so, obviously, they just keep following in line with the, and this just causes more expansion and more expansion of the government. So, back to the article. That is permissible under the court's previous case law for several reasons. The amount of money due is far less than the price of insurance. Well, for how long? Once they put this thing into place and they realize that they're not being able to cover, and that those who are opting out only until they need the insurance and then they buy the insurance, and so they're going without the fee, and then they're automatically getting insurance once they're sick because they can't be disqualified from that. Then they're realizing that they've got to up the price because it's going to make the insurance companies go bankrupt, which may be their plan in the long run, but I can't imagine the insurance companies not trying to lobby Congress to change that. So we don't know how long this minimum price, this far less than the price of insurance, is going to last. We'll see in just a moment when I actually calculate this out that that's not true. It's actually going to be far more expensive in some respects. And is also collected by the IRS under normal means of taxation. What's the normal means of taxation? It's coercion. It's requirement by force. That's how the IRS normally, or what does it say? Normal means of taxation. That's coercive government is what that is. Next paragraph. The court acknowledges that the mandate is plainly designed to expand health insurance coverage. Well, I would agree with that. And noted that taxes that seek to influence conduct are nothing new. For example, the taxing of cigarettes to discourage smoking. Okay, so here again they go to this whole concept of, well, we'll put a tax on smoking so that people are discouraged from smoking. Well, what, they're putting a tax on opting out of insurance so that opting out of insurance is not healthy? What if somebody doesn't want the insurance? What if they got their own private program? You know, we're a part of Samaritan's Ministry, which is a nonprofit Christian organization that shares one another's medical bills. We're not insurance. We don't claim to be insurance. We don't participate as insurance. We cash pay all of our medical bills, and we're reimbursed from other brothers and sisters in Christ. So we don't participate in insurance. That's what we do for our family, and we love it. That's what we want. That's the biblical model. That's what we like. But we're going to be penalized according to this law, because we're not participating in the program that the way that they would like. So we're going to have to pay an extra tax. Well, how does that incentivize us to do what's good? We like what we're doing right now. It's just ridiculous. If I'm getting upset in my voice, you can tell it's because I am upset. It drives me crazy. All right. Next paragraph says, finally, the court reasoned that the mandate does not make the failure to buy health insurance unlawful. Okay, so apparently it's not unlawful. It's not illegal not to buy insurance. Well, if it's not illegal, then why do they place a fee upon us? Or so now I guess it's called the tax if we're not going to pay for that. It sounds to me like it's a either you pay or you play kind of deal. Well, that sounds pretty much like coercion to me. And if you don't pay, what if you don't pay the tax? Well, then that would be unlawful and you can go to jail, right? Well, then it sounds to me like you either pay or you play. Beyond the payment of the IRS, the court explains, neither the act nor any other law attach negative legal consequences to not buying the health insurance. Sure it does. That's just playing games with names there. The article goes on, so I'm going to have to pay more tax now probably. Starting in 2016, when the shared responsibility payment, I just hate that phrase, shared responsibility payment. Starting in 2016, when the shared responsibility payment is fully in place, the amount you would owe for not having health insurance is the greater of 2.5% of your income or $695. No one's going to pay the $695. There is currently no means to criminally prosecute those who do not have health insurance and also refuse to pay the shared responsibility. How long will that last? That there's no criminal... See, everybody's going to do this. Everybody's going to opt out. They're going to pay the fee, and then as soon as they get health insurance, or as soon as they get sick, they're going to get the health insurance, or at least, you know, people that would get by with, you know, less. Obviously, those who are wealthy. Now, I figured this out. 2.5%, I have a couple of friends of mine who are making over $500,000 a year. So if they choose to pay for their own medical needs and not to get insurance, or maybe they're a part of Samaritan Ministry like I am, or some of these other Christian ministries that share one of those medical bills, something like that. $500,000 income, 2.5% of that would be $12,500 a year. You can buy any kind of medical insurance coverage you want for $12,500 a year. I mean, just about. And yet that's what they're going to have to pay for the fee. Or, I'm sorry, it's not a fee, it's a tax for this opting out of the government-sponsored health care. And so somebody maybe who's $40,000 a year income, which is more kind of the median income nationwide, they would have to pay a $1,000 fee. So that's, you know, that's $86, $84 a month, something like that, $82 a month. That's not a lot. I mean, that's very little. So what's going to happen is that these people are making $40,000 a year, they're going to opt out. They're not going to pay for the premiums for the health insurance. They're going to opt out, pay their $1,000 fee each year, and then as soon as they have a medical issue that needs to be addressed, they're going to purchase the insurance because they won't be denied. When they purchase the insurance, then they'll pay for the coverage till as long as they need it to get the insurance or to get the treatments that they need, and they'll drop the coverage again. And this is just going to be a fiasco. It's going to cause all kinds of unintended consequences, which is exactly what the government does. Anytime they do something, it creates all kinds of unintended consequences and makes everything more expensive, more inefficient, and takes away more of our freedoms. So what about the Medicaid expansion? Well, you know what? I'm not going to read any more of this. You can read the rest of it in the article that I'm going to post on there. But I just wanted to... you know, bring these things to mind because, in fact, I may do more of these periodically as I see articles come through regarding our freedom and challenges to those, to our freedom. And it's important for us to be aware of what's going on. I think it's easy for us to put our head in the sand and say, well, we're the greatest country in the world, which we are, and we're the most free country in the world, which we are. And yet our freedoms are quickly being taken away. And we see examples after example like this, one on the national level, one at the state level, and then one at the local level, all showing that our property rights and, you know, our right to life, our right to liberty, and our right to the pursuit of happiness, which is really property, is quickly being, inch by inch taken from us. And it's important for us to realize that and to fight against it. And I think maybe coming up here for 4th of July, I'm going to do an article, or I'm going to do an episode on some things that we can do to move ourselves closer towards liberty. Maybe some projects, some ideas, some things to do that would move us in that direction. Because I want to give some positive application to this. I don't want us to just think about all the negative that's going on out there and become depressed. I want us to give us some tangible things that we can do to exercise liberty and to pursue liberty for ourselves. And so I'm going to do that here coming up. So stay tuned to that. And until that time, this has been Steve Donahue with the Legacy Podcast, helping you build a multi-generational legacy of abundance. What will you do today to build your legacy?